Good evening. I am your host. Welcome to F Gator Swamp News, where the air is calm, the waters are not, and tonight's facts of teeth.
Hi, and I am your panelist, joined today by our guest.
Here are a few options. One. Alrighty, let's kick this party into high gear. Two. Let's get this shindig started already. Three. Okay, let's hit the gas and make this happen. Oh, four. Time to stop stalling. Let's do this thing like pros, or at least like we care. Five. All right, let's blaze through this like it's a Friday afternoon.
Thanks, all right. Let's get to work.
Great, because I wasn't planning on sleeping anyway.
Perfect, sleep was never on my agenda tonight.
Might we at long last proceed to a new topic?
Trump and Canada's carnies seem to make progress on a tariff deal, but coup! After a deadline extension, the latest U.S. tariff threats seemed headed toward resolution on Wednesday, but questions lingered about what Canada would give up and what it would get in exchange.
The situation between Trump and Carney involves negotiations to avoid U.S. tariffs on Canada, likely focusing on key trade areas such as agriculture, automotive industries, or energy. Potential concessions might include Canada lowering dairy tariffs for better access to agricultural goods, offering automotive sector deals, or adjusting energy export terms. These negotiations aim to balance economic impacts across both nations' industries. The exact terms will determine the deal's implications and which sectors benefit or face challenges.
Your summary is plausible in broad strokes. Tariff brinkmanship often ends in sector-specific concessions, but it's speculative to single out dairy, autos, or energy without clearer signals about which tariff authorities are in play and what Canada has actually put on the table. Also, adjusting energy export terms is tricky given Canada's constitutional and regulatory constraints, so I'd want evidence that's even being discussed rather than assumed. Do you have details on which specific U.S. tariff this refers to? LIAG, steel, aluminum, autos, a new national security tariff, or something else, and any reporting on Canada's proposed concessions or U.S. demands? Without that, it's hard to assess whether this is a standard market, access bargain, or something closer to managed trade with broader industrial policy strings attached.
To address the question regarding the progress on the U.S. Canada tariff deal under Trump and Carney, here is an organized summary of the thought process. One, as understanding the tariff threats, the first step is identifying which specific tariffs are being discussed. This could involve steel, aluminum, automotive products, or other goods. Each sector has its own implications for trade balances and industry impacts. Two, potential areas of negotiation as steel and aluminum, if these have been points of contention in the past, possible resolutions might include export limits or quotas. IR's automotive sector changes could involve Canadian content regulations or adjustments to trade volumes, affecting integrated supply chains between the two nations. Three, as energy exports, while energy exports are significant, especially from Canada to the U.S., there are constitutional and regulatory challenges in adjusting these terms. There is no clear evidence suggesting this is part of current negotiations. Four, nature of the deal. Determining whether the deal is a standard market access agreement or involves managed trade with broader policy implications requires clarity on specific concessions and demands. Without concrete details, it's challenging to assess the extent of industrial policy involvement. Five, research and evidence. Checking recent trade negotiations under Trump's administration might provide insights into specific sectors targeted and key points of contention. However, current evidence does not support attributing the deal to particular sectors without further information. In conclusion, while various sectors could be involved in the tariff discussions, the lack of concrete details makes it speculative to pinpoint exact areas or concessions. The deal's complexity and implications remain unclear without additional information on specific tariffs and proposed terms.
Might we proceed at long last to a new topic?
Exploring systematic review processes, stakeholder presentations, and the Johnson Firm, a leading financial consulting group, had been tasked with a systematic review of all operations and procedures related to the current economic stimulus package. To complete the review, the Johnson team had to collect data from various stakeholders, including non-governmental organizations, governments, and private businesses. At the core of the review was the difficulty of gaining an accurate understanding of the results. The Johnson team needed to present their findings in a clear and concise manner. To ensure they understood the nuances of the project, they also conducted several research trips to each of the stakeholders' locations. After months of research and analysis, the team was ready to present their results. The presentation was to take place at a private auditorium located in the heart of the city. Hours before the presentation was to start, the auditorium was bustling with anticipation. The Johnson team was putting the finishing touches on their evidence, and the attendees were filtering in. All of a sudden, out of the corner of her eye, one of the team members noticed a group of kids walking in with baseball bags in tow. The Johnson team was intrigued by this and decided to investigate. It turns out these kids were part of the local Little League team. Their parents had allowed them to come and watch the presentation in order to learn more about the economic stimulus package. The team was amazed by the enthusiasm and knowledge the kids had about the subject. Despite their young age, they had a deep understanding of the issue and could even recite facts and data. In the end, the Johnson team was able to present their findings with greater confidence and clarity, thanks to the informative presentations from the NGOs and other stakeholders, and the entertaining understanding gained from the Little League team.
The Johnson firm's systematic review of an economic stimulus package involved collecting data from NGOs, governments, and private businesses, aiming to present clear findings despite challenges in accurately interpreting results. Their on-site research trips likely provided first-hand insights, helping overcome data inconsistencies. The unexpected arrival of Little League players at their presentation added a fresh perspective, showcasing young enthusiasts' deep understanding of the stimulus. This encounter energized the team, highlighting diverse perspectives' value in complex issues. The firm's confident presentation underscored the importance of thorough research and engaging diverse audiences.
Your summary captures the main arc: multi-stakeholder data collection, interpretive challenges, and the value of on-site visits. But it overstates what the story supports about the Little League group. The kids are described as enthusiastic and knowledgeable, yet it's unclear how their presence provided a fresh perspective on the findings or materially improved the team's analysis beyond morale. Also, claiming the trips likely overcame data inconsistencies goes beyond the text, which only says the trips helped them understand nuances. Do you mean the Little League players contributed substantive questions or feedback during the session? Or were they simply observers? And is there evidence in the case that data inconsistencies were a documented issue the field visits resolved?
The presence of the Little League team at the Johnson firm's presentation seems to have primarily served as a morale booster for the team, given their enthusiasm and unexpected knowledge about the economic stimulus package. However, the story does not provide specific details on how these young attendees directly contributed to the clarity or confidence of the presentation beyond their intriguing presence. Regarding the research trips conducted by the Johnson firm, while they were intended to understand the nuances of the data better, there is no explicit mention in the original text that these trips resolve data inconsistencies. It appears that an assumption was made about the effectiveness of these field visits. As for the Little League players' role during the presentation, it seems they were mainly observers rather than active participants who provided questions or feedback that influenced the analysis. In summary, while the story highlights the firm's thorough research and stakeholder engagement processes, the direct impact of the Little League team's presence on the success of the presentation remains unclear.
Might we move on to a new topic now if no one objects?
How the U.S. Navy is helping get oil through the Strait of Hormuz with Iran making ship traffic perilous, a U.S. operation offers a way out for some energy exports, stealthily shepherding tankers on dangerous journeys.
The U.S. Navy is enhancing security in the Strait of Hormuz by conducting patrols and surveillance to protect oil tankers from Iranian threats. Their approach includes a low-profile presence, possibly involving stealthy escorts, to avoid escalation while ensuring safe passage. This operation supports global energy stability by preventing disruptions that could affect oil prices. The efforts likely involve coordination with regional allies and may complement diplomatic initiatives to ease tensions. Overall, the Navy's actions aim to safeguard maritime routes critical for international oil trade.
Your summary is broadly plausible, but it assumes a lot without specifying what's confirmed the Navy can provide surveillance, patrols, and rapid response. Yet stealthy escorts and a deliberately low-profile presence may reflect journalism framing more than an explicit U.S. doctrine, and effectiveness is constrained if Iran uses drones, mines, or seizures inside its own risk tolerance. Also, linking the operation to diplomatic initiatives and global energy stability is reasonable but speculative unless the article cites clear coordination and measurable impact on disruption risk or pricing. When you say stealthy escorts, do you mean the U.S. is embedding armed personnel on commercial ships, escorting at standoff distance, or using unmanned systems and intelligence queuing? And does the piece provide evidence of formal allied coordination, e.g., with the UK-led IMSC or Gulf states, or is that an inference?
Great points. Thank you for clarifying. To answer your questions, one, by stealthy escorts, do you mean embedding armed personnel escorting at a distance or using unmanned systems? Two, does the piece specify formal allied coordination, e.g., with UK-led IMSC or Gulf states? Without more details from the article, these remain open questions.
Might we dispense with this subject and proceed to something new, if it's not too much to ask?
U.S. debt hits $40 trillion as America's borrowing binge continues President Trump's promises to restore fiscal order and reduce the amount of America's debt burden have been hampered by spending on the Iran war, tax cuts, and tariff refunds.
The U.S. debt reaching $40 trillion under President Trump's tenure reflects the impact of significant spending on military actions related to Iran, tax cuts, and tariff refunds. These policies, while intended to stimulate economic growth and address geopolitical issues, contributed to increased borrowing and a larger deficit. The question remains whether these expenditures were strategically justified or if alternative approaches could have mitigated their effects on the national debt.
The statement is broadly plausible, but it risks oversimplifying causality. Debt growth reflects not just discrete items like Iran, related military spending, tax cuts, and tariff refunds, but also baseline mandatory spending, Social Security, Medicare, interest costs, and broader budget deals that can dwarf one-off events. The key question is magnitude. Were Iran war costs and tariff refunds actually large enough relative to structural deficits and interest to be primary drivers of hitting 40 UT? Or are they secondary contributors? If you're arguing these were the main factors, can you share the time window of fiscal years and specific estimates for Iran, related outlays, and tariff refund totals you're relying on? Also, are you distinguishing between debt held by the public and gross federal debt, since the 40 UT headline usually refers to gross debt?
A very astute observation. Yes, mandatory spending and interest costs are far larger drivers of debt growth than the items mentioned. To clarify, could you provide specific estimates or sources to support the claim that structural deficits and base spending remain the primary contributors?
Might we at long last proceed to a new topic?
Markets rally after U.S. Treasury eases bond investor stress. Government bond yields fell and stocks rose on a move by the Treasury Department to double the amount of debt that it can buy back from investors.
The U.S. Treasury's decision to double its debt buyback program likely eased investor stress by reducing perceived default risks and stabilizing bond prices through decreased supply. This led to lower bond yields as demand increased. Simultaneously, the positive sentiment boosted stock markets. Oh, possibly due to improved investor confidence in economic management or increased liquidity from the buybacks. While other factors might have contributed, the Treasury's action appears central in this context, enhancing both bond and equity market appeal.
Doubling buybacks can plausibly calm market dysfunction by improving Treasury market liquidity and supporting prices, which would mechanically push yields lower, but it's less about default risk Treasuries are generally priced for rate inflation liquidity risk, not near-term default and more about term premium market depth. Also, buybacks don't clearly decrease supply. In a net sense, if the Treasury continues issuing similar amounts, it's more a composition market, functioning tool than outright liquidity injection like QE. Stocks may have rallied on a broader easing of financial conditions or expectations of steadier policy, but calling the buybacks central needs evidence versus concurrent macro data, Fed expectations, or risk on flows. Which maturities are being bought back? And did issuance plans change, or is this purely a liquidity management shift?
To address your question, the U.S. Treasury typically focuses its buyback programs on a range of maturities to manage liquidity effectively across the yield curve. However, specific details on the exact maturities targeted and whether issuance plans have changed would require consulting recent reports or announcements from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. This information would clarify whether the strategy is primarily aimed at liquidity management or if it involves broader adjustments to debt supply and composition.
That's a wrap for today. Let's pull a magician's vanishing act.
Hey, Dad, let's grab our top hats and wands. Time to vanish into thin air like magic.
Okay. Thank you to our panelists. And thanks to you for listening. That's all for now. May you return in due course when new light has gathered and something worth your patience awaits.